They got to work hard. They must be worth their weight to me, Smee, or it's over the side.
Smee looked down at his own belly. It was not a small belly. Blackstache caught the look and smiled broadly, showing his brown tooth stumps. He continued to smile as the dory with its squirming and terrified passengers was cut loose and quickly fell behind the Sea Devil, growing smaller by the minute until it was gone, along with most of the Sea Devil's water.
"Good riddance," Blackstache growled, and he spat again, a major gob, this time hitting Smee's other foot. He turned to face the crew, now watching him warily. "The dead weight is gone, men," he said. "We're picking up speed."
He gestured toward the dot on the horizon that was the Wasp.
"She's a fast ship, but we're going to be faster. We'd better be, because your water rations are gone in 3 days' time. So work hard, men, work hard, if you don't want to join those two bales of lard drifting astern."
Blackstache glared at the crew, daring anyone to challenge him. His glare was met by a fearful silence.
"Good," said Blackstache. "Now, let's get more sail up."
The pirates scurried into action as if their lives depended on it, which they did. Blackstache turned to Smee.
"I'll be in my cabin," he said. "When I come back, I want that ship,"
he pointed to the distant Wasp,
"to be closer. If it's not, we'll have to toss some more weight over the side."
He looked pointedly at Smee's belly, then turned and stalked off. Smee pushed the men hard all afternoon, and ate no dinner that night. Chapter 7. Peter Ventures Aft. By the third day, the boys were so hungry that when Hungry Bob bought their daily slop, they actually ate some of it. They picked carefully through the lumps, still, to Hungry Bob's delight, passing on the wriggling ones and choking down others as best they could. But it wasn't enough food, not nearly enough. Hunger now clawed constantly at their bellies. Peter, wondering if it was such a good thing to be the leader, was feeling intense pressure to do something. He had given up on pleading the boys' case to Captain Pembridge. Several times now the boys had heard the captain staggering around on the main deck, shouting senseless commands.
"Heave to on the stizzens! Furl the yardarm!"
to the vast enjoyment of the crew. Pembridge sounded even more confused than he'd been the first day. The sailors mocked him openly now. No, Pembridge would be no help, and Peter didn't dare approach Slank. To ask him for better food would be to ask for a lashing. And so, as the third day turned into the third night and the boys prepared for another restless, hungry night in their dank little cabin, listening to James whimpering and rats scuttling, Peter made up his mind. He would steal some food. There had to be decent food on the ship. Slank surely wasn't eating the swill that the boys got, and he just as surely wasn't feeding it to the first-class passengers, like that girl Molly and her governess. No, they were eating decent food, and Peter meant to have some of it. He figured it was stored in the aft part of the ship, where the important people slept and the valuable items were stored. He'd done some poking around and determined that there was no way he could go aft below decks without passing through the crew's quarters, where he would surely be seen. His plan, then, was to wait for dark, then sneak aft on the main deck. He waited until an hour past sunset, then carefully detached himself from the clump of dozing boys huddled together on the floor for warmth and protection from the rats. Tubby Ted continued to snore, but James sat up, rubbing his eyes, and said,
"Peter, where are you going?"
"Quiet,"
Peter hissed.
"I'm going to look for food."
"I'll go with you,"
said another voice, Prentice.
"And I," said Thomas. "Bring me a ham sandwich," said Tubby Ted, awakened by the talk of food.
"I'm going alone," said Peter, ducking out of the room, "and I'll bring back what I can."
"Be careful,"
said James behind him.
"Also some cheese," said Tubby Ted.
Peter climbed the ladder to the deck, poked his head up and looked around. He saw a small knot of crewmen a few yards aft, looking off the ship's port rail, talking. Otherwise, the deck appeared to be empty. He eased himself out of the ladderway and slid on his belly to the starboard side, away from the men. Then, on hands and knees, he crawled aft. As he neared the stern of the ship, he heard loud talk and laughter coming from a cabin window. He recognized Slank's booming voice and the high-pitched giggle of Molly's governess, Mrs. Bumbrake.
"Oh, Mr. Slank,"
she was saying.
You are a devil!
That I am, Mrs. Bumbrake, Boom Slank. And you know what they say.
What do they say, Mr. Slank?
They say, roared Slank, the devil take the hindmost.
Then Peter heard Mrs. Bumbrake emit a very ungovernous-like squeal, followed by what sounded like a slap, followed by some thumping, then more squealing, then more thumping, and then much laughing. From the sound of it, Peter figured they wouldn't be breaking up the party any time soon.
That takes care of Slank, he thought. Now all I have to worry about is the big man with the whip.
He checked around to make sure nobody was watching, then got to his feet, tiptoed aft, and descended some steps to a dimly lit corridor, flanked by four cabin doors. Molly is probably in one of these cabins, he thought, moving silently until he reached a narrow ladderway leading down. Heart pounding, he descended the ladder and found himself in darkness. He felt his way along the floor with his feet, toes outstretched. He then stood still for perhaps a minute, waiting as his eyes began to pick up what little light filtered down the ladderway from above. He saw he was in a long, low space. At the end was a doorway, and Peter froze. On the floor, by the doorway, was a man's body. It lay slumped against the wall, head lagging sideways, and it was snoring. Peter relaxed a little. He peered at the sleeping man's face and recognized him as a member of the crew. Next to the man on the floor was a lantern which apparently had gone out. The man's right hand was loosely curled around a wooden club about 2 feet long.
He's on watch, Peter thought. He's guarding the door, and he let the lantern go out, or he put it out, and he fell asleep.
Peter thought about it some more.
If he's on watch, whatever's in that room is important. Maybe they keep the good food in there.
He hesitated, weighing the risk of waking the guard against the hope of finding food. Then his stomach growled, making the decision for him. Peter crept forward, keeping an eye on the sleeping man. He reached the door and put his hand on the knob, worried that the door would be locked, only to find that not only was it unlocked, it was slightly ajar.
That's odd.
Peter gently pushed the door open and stepped inside. Again, he waited for his eyes to adjust, as this room was even darker. He heard a scuttling sound, but it was one he'd become all too familiar with.
Rats. Please don't bite me, he thought. I'm here for the same reason you are.
In a few moments he began to make out a bulky shape, perhaps 5 feet in front of him. Holding his hands before him, sliding his feet, he started toward it, and
what was that?
It was a noise in the corner, something moving.
It sounds too big to be a rat.
Peter froze again, peering toward the source of the sound, and he saw something green. No, two green things, glowing, hovering.
Peter stared at them and realized, those are eyes. But what has eyes that glow like that?
Peter was not interested in finding out. He turned and bolted for the doorway and thump! Peter bounced off a stout body and fell backward onto the floor. He'd run into the guard, who was now awake and unhappy.
Ooh!
Growled the guard, stumbling backward. He caught himself and lumbered forward into the room, shouting,
what do you think you're... Ooh!
The guard, seeing poorly in the dark room, had tripped over Peter's legs. He stumbled and pitched forward head first, falling and striking something behind Peter. Seeing his chance to escape, Peter scrambled to his feet and darted through the doorway, determined to get out of there as quickly as possible, only to stop when he heard the sailor's astonished,
"Wah!"
Unable to control his curiosity, Peter risked a backward glance. The guard was on his hands and knees next to the bulky shape on the floor. Peter, his eyes now fully adjusted to the darkness, recognized it as the canvas-wrapped cargo he'd seen being carried aboard the ship. The guard, his mouth agape, was staring at something above the shape.
A rat. In mid-air. A rat floating in mid-air.
Peter blinked his eyes, but there was no question. The rat was suspended in space as if hanging from a string.
But there was no string.
As Peter and the guards stared at the rat, it waved its legs slowly, almost languidly, as if swimming, and began to drift toward the doorway, toward Peter. Peter knew he should run, but could not move his legs, could not take his eyes off the airborne rodent now coming through the doorway. When it was about 2 feet away, it seemed to notice him and, moving its right feet in a paddling motion, altered its course to the left, so as to just miss Peter's head. Riveted to the spot, Peter watched it come, swiveling his head as it drew closer, closer, and Peter jumped as a hand gripped his arm.
"Peter!"
a voice whispered. Peter jerked his head around and saw Molly.
"Where did she come from?"
"Molly," he said.
"What are you—" "Need to get out of here now,"
she said, pulling him away from the doorway. Behind him, Peter heard the guard stumbling to his feet.
"Here now,"
the guard was shouting.
"Stop, whoever you are."
Peter felt Molly dragging him to the ladder.
"Come on,"
she said, reaching the ladder and swiftly ascending it. Peter followed, his mind swirling now, thinking about the flying rat, remembering the eyes he'd seen glowing in the dark. Molly has green eyes. They reached the next deck. Behind and below them, the guard was still yelling for them to stop. Peter started toward the stairway leading up to the main deck, but Molly grabbed his arm, opened a door, pulled him inside, and closed the door behind them. It was a small cabin, but cozy. Two bunks, one slung over the other, a tiny bureau. The cabin smelled of lavender and face powder. This was obviously where Molly and Mrs. Bumbrake stayed.
"Molly," said Peter,
"what—"
He was silenced as Molly clapped her hand over his mouth. She nodded toward the door. Peter heard the sound of boots clomping down the stairway, then past the cabin door. Big boots.
"The man with the whip,"
thought Peter.
"Little Richard."
Molly silently opened the door just as the top of the huge man's head disappeared down the ladderway.
"Go,"
said Molly, pushing Peter out of the door,
"before Slink gets here."
"All right," said Peter, "but what was—"
"There's no time," said Molly. "Here, take this."
She turned, snatched a brown paper package from the bureau, and shoved it into his hand.
"Now, go!"
Peter heard more boot steps on the deck. Clutching the package, he raced up the stairway and, keeping low, scooted forward along the ship's starboard rail. Behind him, he heard more yelling. One of the voices was Slank's, but Peter's path was clear, and he reached the forward ladderway unnoticed. He darted down it and, with great relief, ducked into the boy's cramped little space, which, at this moment, seemed almost pleasant. James sat up.
"Peter," he said, "you're back."
Peter slumped to the floor, breathing hard, his heart pounding.
"What happened?" said Prentice.
"Are you all right?" said Thomas. "You look scared."
"I'm not scared," said Peter, too quickly.
"What happened?" repeated Prentice.
"Well," said Peter, not sure how much he should tell or how much the others would believe, "there was this room, and—"
"Did you get food?"
interrupted Tubby Ted.
"Well," said Peter, "I was trying to—"
"You did,"
said Tubby Ted, spying the package and grabbing it from Peter's hands.
"You got food."
"But that's—" Peter was interrupted by the boys' shouts of delight as Tubby Ted ripped open the brown paper and triumphantly held up a loaf of bread.
"Peter,"
said James,
"you did it."
"Yes," said Peter, quietly looking at the bread.
"Of course."
They managed to pry the loaf out of Tubby Ted's hands long enough to divide it five ways. Although they could have eaten several more loaves, the worst of their hunger pangs was satisfied, and after they'd finished the last crumbs, they all quickly drifted off to sleep. All, that is, except Peter, who tossed restlessly, reviewing his strange experience in the aft hold, questions swarming in his brain. How could a rat fly? What was going on in that hold? Why were they guarding it? Why was Molly down there? Had those been her eyes he'd seen in the dark? They had to have been. But what kind of person has eyes like that? Eyes that glow in the dark? How on earth could a rat fly? The more Peter pondered these questions, the more he became convinced that the answers, whatever they were, had something to do with the trunk. The same trunk that had made that sailor act so strange on the day the ship left port. Peter went over it again and again in his mind, trying to remember if he'd seen anything else in the hold. There was nothing, he decided. Only the trunk. That's what they were guarding. I'm going to find out what's in there. Chapter 8. Adrift in a Dory. Preston and Harbuckle, their hands tied to their feet behind their backs, lay on their fat bellies on the bottom of the dory, looking like a pair of pudgy rocking horses. Their situation, bound and gagged, abandoned at sea without food or water, had been bad enough to begin with, but it was getting worse. They'd been drifting for a while now, each man struggling in vain to get free of his ropes. And now Preston, exhausted from the effort, could see that the water sloshing around the bottom with him was definitely higher. The dory was leaking.
Figures, Preston thought. Blackstache wouldn't waste a good boat just to kill us.
Preston strained to look around. He could see that the dory was riding lower now. As the waves rolled it, water sometimes sloshed over the sides. The little boat was going down.
I'm gonna drown, thought Preston.
He felt a momentary pang of regret that he had not spent more time with his beloved wife, but it passed when he remembered that the reason he'd gone to sea in the first place was that he had never really liked his beloved wife. The water in the dory was definitely higher now. Preston, who was not the world's foremost thinker, was doing his best to formulate some kind of plan when he heard Harbuckle, in the front of the dory, say something through his gag. It sounded like. Preston craned his neck to see his shipmate, who was looking back at him with a certain urgency in his eyes. Harbuckle said, arching his eyebrows in a meaningful way. Preston sensed that Harbuckle was trying to tell him something. He queried. Repeated Harbuckle, adding, Harbuckle rolled sideways, so his back was to Preston. He looked over his shoulder and made a violent look-down-there nod with his head toward his bound hands, the fingers of which were wiggling. He said, sounding very impatient now.
Ah, thought Preston, he wants me to do something.
This seemed to Preston like a sound idea, doing something. But what? Preston made a frowny face at Harbuckle to indicate
war.
Looking exasperated, Harbuckle rolled toward Preston, then rolled away again, again nodding violently toward his hands. He said,
and suddenly Preston understood. He wants me to roll over so he can untie my hands. What a good idea.
He nodded his head violently to indicate that he understood. Then, with a massive heave, he rolled his bulky body toward Harbuckle's. The good news was, Preston's roll took him just the right distance. He and Harbuckle were now back to back, their hands just touching. The bad news was, by shifting his massive weight forward to join Harbuckle's, he had overburdened the bow of the dory, and cold seawater was now sloshing into the tiny boat. Shouted Harbuckle, and Preston felt his shipmate's hands clawing frantically at the knots on his own. He tried to hold still, but as the water rose, he had to squirm and struggle to keep his head above it. But the water was coming in fast, and Preston could no longer grab any gasps of air, and so he held his breath as long as he could until his lungs screamed in agony, and he grabbed at his aching chest and...
Wait a minute.
He was grabbing his chest, which meant his hands were free. Desperately thrusting himself up, Preston got to his knees, tore the gag from his mouth, and gulped sweet sea air. He saw that the dory was now swamped, but he was still alive. He could barely believe it. A moment ago, he'd been at death's door, but now here he was, still breathing, and he owed it all to...
Harbuckle.
Preston plunged his head back underwater and found his shipmate's body, not moving. Frantic, Preston grabbed Harbuckle by the hair and yanked his head to the surface, where, thank goodness, it made a faint moaning sound. Preston yanked the gag from Harbuckle's mouth, which began to cough, and then spew seawater, and then, finally, to speak.
You idiot!
It said.
You rock-headed lobster brain moron!
I'm sorry, mate, said Preston. I forgot you was down there.
You forgot I was down there?
Said Harbuckle.
I untie your hands and save your worthless life, and you forgot I was down there.
Only for a minute, said Preston.
Untie my hands, said Harbuckle, so I can wring your neck.
Harbuckle calmed down as Preston untied him, and as both men began to understand that, although they had escaped immediate death, their long-term prospects were not good. They tried using their hands to bail out the dory, but it was hopeless. For every handful of water they scooped out, the waves brought more in. Eventually they stopped trying, as exhaustion, cold, and despair settled in. And then Preston saw it on the horizon.
Look!
He shouted, pointing. Harbuckle squinted, and he saw it too. A mast. Harbuckle said.
You don't suppose...
They're coming back for us.
That couldn't be good,
Harbuckle said.
No,
agreed Preston. Perilous as their situation was, it was probably better than whatever Black Stash would have in store.
Wait a second,
said Harbuckle, squinting hard.
That ain't the Sea Devil.
Preston took a long look.
It ain't the Wasp either, he said.
The two pirates looked at each other, then both rose up, nearly capsizing the swamp dory, and began waving their arms frantically.
Over here!
They shouted.
We're over here!
With agonizing slowness, the distant ship drew closer. The two castaways, their voices growing hoarse, kept shouting and waving, desperate for a sign of recognition. Finally, Preston saw it.
Someone's waving at us!
He shouted, jumping up so violently that the much-abused dory finally did capsize, leaving the two pirates swimming, or trying to. But there was no question. The ship was steering toward them now, and as it drew close, both men could clearly see the person who'd been waving at them, the person who'd seen them first, and saved their sorry lives.
Why?
Said Harbuckle.
It's a boy.
Chapter 9. The Rescue. Peter leaned over the port rail to watch as the two fat, wet men clinging to knotted ropes were hauled slowly aboard the Neverland. The seas swelled and shifted, the fat men crying out as they swung like pendulums. Peter had seen the drowning men first. He'd pointed them out to a sailor who'd run to tell Slank. Peter had kept waving as the Neverland grew closer, to let the men know they'd be rescued. And now as they were hauled aboard, Peter was as curious as anyone else to learn who they were and how they got into their predicament. He joined the crowd, forming a circle around the men as they sat on the deck, dripping, panting, looking apprehensively up at their rescuers. Peter noticed Molly on the other side of the circle. Their eyes met for a moment, then Peter looked away.
Why do I always look away?
Move aside,
said Slank, shoving his way through the crowd. He stood over the two men and said,
Do you speak English?
The fatter of the two, though not by much, nodded, coughed, and said,
Yes, sir.
What are your names?
Asked Slank.
What ship are you from, and how did you end up in the sea?
My name is Harbuckle, sir, said the fatter one. This here is Preston. We thank you, sir, for saving our lives. We were surely...
Slank interrupted.
I asked you what ship you're from,
he said,
and how you wound up in the sea.
We're from the Marcel,
said Harbuckle. The slightly slimmer fat man, Preston, looked at his mate, puzzled.
No, we're not,
he said.
We're from the un...
His sentence was cut short by a sharp blow to the side of his head from Harbuckle.
Aye,
said Preston, rubbing his head.
Don't pay him no mind, said Harbuckle to Slank. He's confused from swallowing seawater. He knows good and well we're from the Marcel.
Harbuckle was glaring at Preston now.
Got that, mate? The Marcel.
Is that so?
Said Slank quietly.
Yes, sir, said Harbuckle. It surely is. She went down in a storm, a bad one. We was lucky to get the dory launched, sir, and if you hadn't come along, we...
I know the Marcel,
interrupted Slank.
You do?
Said Harbuckle, looking surprised.
I do, said Slank. Tell me, did Captain Ferguson go down with the ship?
Harbuckle hesitated, then said,
Aye, sir, that he did. He was a courageous man, Captain Ferguson.
Yes, said Slank. He was. Now, there's one more thing I need you to tell me.
What's that, sir?
Said Harbuckle. Slank drew his knife, the blade's honed edge glinting.
What part of you do I feed to the sharks first?
The crowd gasped, some drawing back, some moving in for a better view.
No,
said Harbuckle, his fear-widened eyes riveted on the knife.
Please, sir, why?
Because you're a lying piece of kelp, said Slank. The Marcel is commanded by Captain Page. Captain Ferguson died 20 years ago.
Slank took a step toward Harbuckle, who scrambled backward.
Please, sir,
he screamed.
No, no, I'll tell you the truth.
And what would that be? Snarled Slank.
We was thrown off the Sea Devil,
said Harbuckle. Another gasp from the crowd. Slank barked out a laugh.
Do you expect me to believe that Black Stash would sail with a pair of fat slugs like you?
It's true, sir,
said Harbuckle.
I swear it.
He turned to Preston.
Tell him, Preston. Tell him what ship we're from.
Preston frowned. The Marcel, he said.
No,
shouted Harbuckle. But you said...
Tell him the truth before he kills us, you idiot,
screamed Harbuckle.
Well, make up your mind, said Preston.
To Slank, he said,
I tried to tell you, we're from the Sea Devil.
Slank studied the two men.
All right, then, he said. If you're from the Sea Devil, what were you doing in the sea? And before you answer, know this. If I think you're lying, you'll go right back into the sea.
He flashed the blade.
In pieces.
Harbuckle gulped.
Sir, he said, Backstash put us adrift in a dory.
And why would he do that?
Said Slank.
To lighten the Sea Devil, said Harbuckle, to give her speed. He even threw most of the water barrels overboard.
Another crowd gasped.
You're lying, said Slank, stepping forward again. No captain throws water overboard.
It's true, said Harbuckle. Blackstash is mad. He says now the crew will have to catch the Wasp to get the water.
The Wasp? Said Slank.
Blackstash is after the Wasp. Peter noticed that across the circle, Molly had moved forward a step. Her father is aboard the Wasp.
Yes, said Harbuckle. He says there's a treasure on the Wasp.
And what would that be? Said Slank.
He didn't specify, said Harbuckle. He just said it was a great treasure, the greatest treasure ever taken to sea, he says.
Peter saw Molly frown.
The greatest treasure ever taken to sea, repeated Slank softly.
That's what he says, said Harbuckle.
Any clue as to the nature of this treasure? Slank asked.
A trunk, Harbuckle said. It's in a trunk. Blackstash has a prisoner, an officer of the Royal Guard. He's the one told Blackstash about the trunk. Says a fine trunk was brought aboard just before the Wasp set sail, escorted by a dozen armed men.
What's in this trunk? Said Slank.
Molly was staring hard at the pirate now.
I don't know, said Harbuckle. The guardsman prisoner don't know neither. Just that it's to go from the Queen of England to the King of Rundoon by the fastest ship afloat under the heaviest guard. Whatever it is in there, it's important enough to have two royals concerned about it.
Slank stared out to sea for a long moment, then looked back down at Preston and Harbuckle, who watched him fearfully, awaiting their fate. Another long moment passed. Finally, Slank spoke.
You're pirate scum, he said.
Yes, sir, said Harbuckle. But we...
Shut up, said Slank. You're pirate scum, and what I should do is throw you both over the side right now.
Harbuckle whimpered. Preston wet his pants, but nobody could tell as his clothes were already soaked.
But I'm going to let you live, said Slank.
Thank you, sir, said Harbuckle. 1,000...
Shut up, said Slank. I'm going to let you live for now, because you might be useful. For now. Little Richard!
The giant loomed behind Slank, his whip coiled on his fat leather belt.
Take this pirate scum below. The rest of you men, get back to work!
The crowd dispersed, the sailors murmuring about the drama they'd just watched. Peter edged his way toward Molly, who was still staring at the spot where Harbuckle had lain.
Molly? He said.
She looked up at him, her face blank, her green eyes devoid of their usual sparkle.
What? She said. I know your father is on the Wasp, he said.
Yes.
Well, I hope he'll be all right.
Thank you. Molly turned to go. Peter could see she didn't want to talk, but he burned with curiosity.
Molly, he said.
She turned back.
I wanted to thank you for last night, Peter said, for helping me.
You're welcome. She started to turn again, but Peter put his hand on her arm.
Wait, he said. What were you doing in that room? What are they keeping there? And did you see the rat in the air? Did you see it?
Molly was staring at him now.
Peter, she said, listen to me. This is very important. You mustn't...
Molly!
The two youngsters were suddenly separated by the massive form of Mrs. Bunbrake, her front side toward Molly, leaving Peter face to face with her formidable backside.
"I told you a thousand times, you're not to be on this deck without me, and you are to stay away from the riffraff."
"But..."
"No back talk, young lady, you come with me."
With Molly in tow, Mrs. Bunbrake barged away, leaving behind a cloud of lavender. Peter watched them go.
"I mustn't what?"
He drifted forward toward a knot of sailors who were pretending to work while they gossiped. There was much to gossip about. There were the two rescued pirates, of course, but also something else, something that had happened last night, news of which was circulating around the ship.
"Guard in the door,"
one of the sailors was saying.
"He says one minute he was wide awake, next minute he wakes up on the floor, like there was a spell cast on him, he says."
Peter moved closer.
"Magic spell?"
scoffed another sailor.
"Not hardly. Too much rum, that's your magic spell."
"No,"
said the storyteller,
"not John. He don't drink, not a drop. That's why Slank gave him the guard duty. No, he says something put him out. And when he woke up, there was people in the room, voices. So John goes running in there, and somebody runs right into him."
"Who?"
"He didn't see. It happened sudden, he says, but whoever it was, he trips John, and down John goes, head first into that trunk."
"What's in that trunk, anyway?"
"Dunno," said the storyteller. "But whatever it is, Slank guards it like gold. So, anyway, John's trying to get up, and his head feels bust open, and he looks up, and then he sees it."
The storyteller paused dramatically.
"What?"
asked one of the listeners.
"He sees what?"
"A rat," said the storyteller. "A flying rat."
"You mean it was jumping? 'Cause I've seen him jump as far as—"
"No," said the storyteller. "John says it was flying."
"That's the bump on his head talking," said one.
"I dunno. It ain't like John to imagine things."
"Well, I don't believe it. I've sailed with rats for 30 years and they don't fly."
"I think it's true," said a new voice from a big man with a big wart on his nose. The sailor Peter had seen acting strange around the mysterious cargo on the first day. He looked around at the group. "I believe John," he said.
"Why's that, Elf?"
"Because the rat was in the room with that trunk. I touched that trunk the day we set sail. There's something strange about it."
"Well, strange is one thing, Elf. Flying rats is another."
"But I'm telling you, I felt it," said Elf. "I felt something, I dunno, magic. I felt like..." Alf looked around, hesitant.
"Like what, Alf?"
Like I could fly," said Alf.
There was a pause, and then the crowd erupted in laughter.
"Sure, Alf, you could fly.
You're a regular bluebird, Alf."
"Look out,"
said somebody.
"Slank's coming."
The sailors, still chuckling, quickly dispersed, leaving Alf red-faced, staring at his feet. Peter hesitated, then approached the big man and tugged at his sleeve. Alf looked down at him.
"What is it, boy?" he said.
"I believe it too," said Peter. "About the rat."
Alf frowned.
"Why?"
he said. Peter hesitated, then said,
"Because I saw it."
Alf bent over, his face now close to Peter's.
"You saw it, boy? You was down there?"
Peter nodded.
"Did you see anything else?" said Alf. "Did you happen to see what's in the trunk?"
"No, sir,"
said Peter. Alf studied him, then spoke softly.
"But you want to,"
he said.
"You want to know what's in there?"
Peter nodded again.
"Me too, boy,"
said Alf.
"Me too."
Chapter 10. Blackstache closes in. Blackstache heard the sharp whistle pierce the night air, sounding like a gull's hungry cry, and lifted his head to see his lookout wave from the crow's nest.
"We're in range."
Stache banged the butt end of his sword on deck twice. Thump, thump. Instantly, the 8 long oars sticking out from the cannon bays lifted from the sea in unison, dripping water, and withdrew into the ship's hull. The crew, desperate now for water as well as treasure, had been hard at it round the clock for almost 2 days straight, working both the sails and oars, reading the winds perfectly, closing the gap on the Wasp. Now they were ready for the final run.
"She's mine!"
Blackstache thumped his sword 3 more times to summon his officers, then retreated below to his cabin, taking a seat at a table covered with navigational charts. Also on the table were 2 small, delicate models of sailing ships, one painted a shiny black like the Wasp, the other a replica of the Sea Devil. There was a tentative tap on the door.
"Come in,"
growled Blackstache. Smee entered and gagged. The cabin smelled like a dead cow. This was because there were, in fact, 7 pieces of dead cow on Blackstache's bunk, as well as a half-eaten carcass of a turkey. Gnawed remnants of other meals littered the floor. Flies buzzed everywhere. Smee held his hand over his nose, trying to be discreet about it.
"You go, Captain,"
he said, his voice muffled.
"It's time," said Stash, staring at the model ships. "The moment is at hand."
"Yes, sir,"
said Smee, turning desperate to escape the eye-watering stench.
"I'll just go up and tell the—"
"Wait," said Blackstache. "I want to go over the final plan with you and Story."
As Smee reluctantly turned back, there was a second knock, and Story, the Sea Devil's crew chief, entered. He fell back momentarily staggered by the odor, then scrunched up his face and forced himself forward into the cabin like a man walking against a gale.
"Aye, Captain,"
he said through gritted teeth.
"Sit down, men," said Stash.
Smee and Story looked around. There was nowhere to sit except the bunk, which was covered with rotting food, and a wooden stool upon which sat a large fur-covered lump, an old cheese, perhaps, or a dead cat.
"If it's all the same, Captain," said Story, "I'll stand."
"Me too, Captain,"
said Smee. Blackstache looked around his cabin, apparently noticing its condition for the first time.
"Smee," he said, "where the devil is my cabin, boy? This place is a mess."
"You had him walk the plank, Captain,"
said Smee.
"I did?"
"You did, Captain,"
said Smee,
"for touching your model ships."
Smee chose not to add that the cabin boy had walked off the ship almost cheerfully, knowing he would no longer have to try to clean Blackstache's cabin.
"Ah, so I did," said Stash. "I'll want you to get me a new cabin boy when we take the Wasp."
"Aye, Captain,"
said Smee. This would be the 6th cabin boy in less than a year.
"Now, about the Wasp," said Blackstache, looking at Story. "Are we ready?"
"We are, Captain,"
said Story. He pointed toward the ship models, careful not to touch them. "We've been gaining steady with the rowing. Now we're sitting just right for a downwind run. Your plan was right on the money, Captain. I don't care how fast the Wasp is with this wind and this heading. When we raise the ladies, we'll close on her in no time."
"And the ladies are ready?" said Blackstache.
"Aye, Captain."
"All right, then," said Blackstache, pausing dramatically, savouring the moment. "Raise the ladies."
"Aye, aye, sir,"
shouted Story and Smee, lunging for the doorway and fresh air. After they left, Blackstache turned his eyes to his model ships. He put his hand gently, almost lovingly, on the model of the Sea Devil. Slowly, he moved it forward until it touched the Wasp. He kept pushing until the Wasp reached the edge of the table. Then, smiling, he gave it a vicious shove. The Wasp model fell, its delicate hull smashing into pieces on the floor. Blackstache laughed, his breath further befouling the rancid cabin air. Then he stood and, stepping on the remains of the Wasp, stalked out of the cabin.
Time for the kill.
Chapter 11. The Messengers. It was just before midnight, an overcast night, no moonlight or starlight reaching the dark deck of the Neverland. The wind was steady at about 5 knots. The fat ship ploughed forward on a following sea. Molly, wearing a blanket like a cloak over her nightgown, emerged from the ladderway and looked quickly around. Seeing no one, she walked swiftly to the stern rail, her feet bare on the scarred wood of the deck. She'd not dared to put on shoes when she'd left the cabin for fear she'd wake the snoring Mrs. Bumbrake. After glancing quickly around again, she leaned over the stern rail and peered out at the dark water. She saw only the ship's churning wake, ghostly pale by the light of the ship's lone stern lantern. Her eyes strained to see more.
Where were they?
She wondered if she was too early, or worse, too late. Telling time on the ship was a problem, especially when overcast skies kept Molly from seeing the stars. 5 minutes went by. To Molly, it felt like an hour.
Where were they?
Molly heard a man's voice, and she tensed, ready to race back to the ladderway. But then she heard another voice, and realized it was two sailors, well forward, passing another long night watch with the endless gossip of a ship at sea. Molly relaxed and turned her gaze back toward the...
What was that?
She squinted at the patch of dark water where she thought she'd seen something, then at the rightmost edge of the roiling wake.
There!
Molly's heart leapt as a grey shape flowed from the water, forming a graceful arc before disappearing again beneath the surface. The shape was followed by another, then another.
Porpoises. 5 of them, their sleek bodies keeping pace effortlessly with the lumbering ship.
Molly leaned over the stern rail and waved frantically, then caught herself, feeling foolish.
They know I'm here, she thought. They see everything.
As if reading her mind, a large porpoise rose straight up, using its powerful tail to lift its head well clear of the water, dancing on the churning water. It looked at Molly, grinning, and said,
Hello.
Not in English, of course. It spoke in clicks and squeaks. But Molly had studied enough porpoise to understand the standard greeting. Struggling to recall her lessons, Molly squeaked and clicked, the clicks were the hardest, something back, which she hoped was, Hello. What she actually said was, My teeth are green. But the porpoise was too polite to point that out. Now the other 4 porpoises rose from the water and, observing the protocol, also said, Hello. Molly told them all that her teeth were green. With the pleasantries out of the way, the lead porpoise, whose name was Arm, made a longer series of clicks and squeaks. Molly knew just enough porpoise to understand that Arm was asking her if she was all right. She expected this question. It had been arranged that the porpoises would check in with Molly tonight, and the assumption had been that Molly would tell them yes, she was all right.
No,
Molly said, struggling to get the sounds right.
Trouble!
This set off a chorus of chittering and chirping among the porpoises, all still standing on their tails. Molly understood none of it, but they were clearly concerned. Arm turned to her again.
Tell me, he said.
Molly had been thinking all day about how, with her very limited porpoise vocabulary, she could say what she had to say. Leaning forward, speaking as clearly as she could, but not too slowly, as porpoises cannot understand slow talking, she said,
Message, father.
Say, said Arm. Molly's heart leapt. She was getting through, but now came the hard part.
Bad man hunt ship, she said.
Again, said Arm. Molly took a deep breath, then,
Bad man hunt ship.
More chittering among the porpoises. Then Arm said,
What ship? Molly ship?
They had understood.
No,
said Molly.
Father ship.
Arm paused, then repeated,
Father ship.
Yes, said Molly, thrilled they were communicating. Urgent chittering, then Arm spoke again.
We go. Goodbye.
No, shouted Molly, so upset that she said it in English, but Arm understood and looked at her expectantly. The other 4 porpoises resurfaced one by one.
More, said Molly.
Say, said Arm.
Molly struggled to form the sounds.
Box on Molly ship.
What on Molly ship?
Asked Arm.
Box, said Molly. Box, box.
What?
It was no use. The sound she was making for box clearly made no sense to Arm. Molly stamped her foot in frustration, trying desperately to think of another way to say it. Maybe she could... Her thoughts were interrupted by voices getting louder behind her. Someone was coming her way. She gestured helplessly to Arm, turned and ran to the ladderway, ducking down it just as the 2 night watch sailors arrived.
Somebody back there talking, one was saying. Slank says we're not to allow...
There's who was talking, said the other, pointing over the side.
Well, I'll be damned, said the first. Porpoises making all that noise. What do you suppose has them so roused up?
Probably saw some tasty fish.
Oh, that's the life, if you ask me. Eat and play, not a care in the world.
Look here, this big one here. He's talking to us. A right speechmaker he is.
Probably wants to throw him a bite to eat.
In fact, Arm was saying something very impolite about the sailors and their ancestors. The other 4 porpoises snorted, then all 5 turned, arced, sliced smoothly into the dark water and disappeared. The 2 sailors watched them go.
Yes, indeed, that's the life,
said the first.
Not a care in the world.
Chapter 12. Angry Words. Peter and James had seen the whole thing. They had crept aft, hoping to find some edible food somewhere, slithering silently past the two gabbing sailors on watch. They were crouched behind a barrel near the stern when they'd seen Molly emerge from the ladderway, go to the rail, and lean over. Peter had been about to approach her when she had started making the strangest noises he'd ever heard a human make.
"Peter," whispered James. "What is she?"
Peter silenced him with a quick squeeze on his arm. He motioned for James to stay low, and the two boys slid on their bellies to a spot where they could peer through an opening in the stern rail and look down at what Molly was seeing. They emitted simultaneous gasps when they saw the five porpoises, which looked as though they were dancing on the water as they used their powerful tails to hold their heads far above the waves. They watched, astonished, as Molly and the largest of the porpoises exchanged the odd noises, almost as if, but that's impossible, they were having a conversation. To Peter, Molly's noises sounded increasingly urgent and frustrated, until finally she broke into English and shouted, "No!" Unable to contain his curiosity any longer, Peter stood to approach her, only to dive back to his belly when he heard the night watch sailors coming. He saw Molly turn and run back to the ladderway as he and James squirmed back behind the barrel. They waited there, afraid to breathe, as the sailors commented on seeing porpoises. Sailors apparently thought porpoises brought good luck. Finally, the sailors climbed to a higher deck and disappeared.
"Peter," whispered James.
"What did we?"
"Not now," whispered Peter.
"Go back to our cabin and don't get caught."
"But where are you?"
"Never mind," hissed Peter. "I'll be along. Just get going."
After seeing that James had crawled away safely, Peter climbed a rope and slipped under a railing that took him to the upper deck. The night watch sailors stood talking not 20 feet away. When the nearest one turned his back, Peter edged along the rail and reached a doorway leading down a ladderway into darkness. Peter looked around, unsure how to get to Molly's cabin from here. He waited, waited, and finally the two sailors agreed it was time for tea. They moved on. Peter slipped down the steep ladderway into a darkened hallway. Yellow light seeped from beneath several doors in both directions. Peter moved on to the next, sticking his ear to the door. He heard loud snoring. Assuming that it was Mrs. Bunbrake, he opened the door and slipped inside.
"Peter,"
whispered Molly.
"What are you doing here?"
"I must talk to you," whispered Peter.
"Now?"
"Now," he said.
Molly frowned, then whispered,
"All right, but outside in the passageway."
They stepped outside, and Molly closed the door.
"I saw you," said Peter.
"Saw me what?" asked Molly. She kept her voice calm, but Peter could tell he'd surprised her.
"You were talking to that fish."
"What on earth are you talking about?"
"You were talking to that fish. You were making strange noises, and it was making them back."
"Don't be silly. Fish can't talk."
"Molly, I saw you."
Molly stared at him for a moment, weighing something. Then she sighed and said,
"All right, listen. Those are not fish. Those are called porpoises, and they breathe air the same way we do."
"But they look like fish."
"But they're not. They breathe air, and they make noises, just like dogs and cats and cows and other animals. I was imitating the noises they made purely out of curiosity to see if I could get a response.
That's all you saw. It was nothing."
"That's not what it looked like," said Peter. "It looked like you were talking to them, and you were upset about something. I heard you shout, 'No!'"
"I was just frustrated because I couldn't make the noises properly,"
said Molly.
"That's all. Nothing more."
"You ran away when the sailors came. Why?" Molly paused, again weighing something, then answered,
"Only because I didn't want them to report me to Mrs. Bunbrake. She told me to stay in the cabin."
"Really, Peter, you're imagining things."
"She's lying."
"I am," said Peter, "and I suppose I imagined the flying rat, and I imagined that you were in that aft hold. What's going on, Molly? Tell me what's going on."
"Nothing, Peter," said Molly. "There's nothing going on."
"Why is she lying?"
"Fine," said Peter. "If you won't tell me, I'll find out for myself."
"No,"
she said with sudden intensity, grabbing his arm with a startlingly powerful grip.
"Peter, you must not go down to that room again. You must not."
Peter yanked his arm away. "Who's going to stop me?" he said. Molly's eyes bored into his. She spoke slowly.
"I will, Peter."
"How?"
he snapped.
"I'll tell Sank," Molly threatened.
"You wouldn't," he said.
"I will if I have to," she said.
"All right, then," said Peter, his cheeks burning, his voice quivering with anger. "I see now that not all the rats on this ship are four-legged." He yanked the door open.
"Please, Peter," said Molly, reaching for his arm again. "You don't understand."
"Goodbye, rat," said Peter, brushing her hand away.
"Peter, please."
He faced her. "You know," he said, I thought we, well, I was obviously wrong. Peter darted up the ladderway to the relative safety of the darkened deck. He crouched for a moment, breathing deeply, seething with feelings of rage and betrayal.
"Think she can lie to me, does she? Think she can tell me what to do? Well, I'll show her I can do this myself, me and Alf. I don't need her help. Who does she think she is?"
Chapter 13. The Ladies. In the darkness just before dawn, Leonard Astor paced back and forth on the stern of the Wasp, his long legs carrying his lanky frame across the beam in just a few strides each way. Again and again he looked into the water. Again and again he saw nothing. "Where are you?" Finally, impatience overcame him. After checking around for observers, he leaned over the rail and made a series of inhuman noises. Almost instantly he saw the glistening silver back of a porpoise break the ship's wake. It rose on its tail, quickly joined by the other four, facing in different directions, as if keeping watch.
"Hello," said Arm.
"Hello," said Astor, anxious to hear news but observing porpoise protocol. "Arm, talk Molly," said Arm.
"What say Molly?"
said Astor, leaning forward eagerly.
"Molly, say three things," said Arm.
"What things?"
"Molly, teeth green."
"Molly, teeth green?"
"Yes."
Astor contemplated that for a moment and decided the problem was likely Molly's limited command of porpoise.
"What more, Molly, say?"
he asked.
"Bad man hunt father ship," said Arm.
Astor felt a chill.
"Again," he said,
and the response was the same.
"Bad man hunt father ship." "Bad man?"
Astor figured he knew who that would be. He thought for a moment, then squeaked a question to the porpoise.
"Arm, see bad man ship?"
The answer was immediate.
"Yes." "Where?"
Chittering among the dolphins, then.
"Near."
"Damn," Astor thought furiously. He needed to see the captain. He started to go, then remembered that Arm had said there were three messages.
"What more, Molly, say?"
Arm hesitated, as if struggling with something, then finally said,
"On Molly's ship."
"What?" said Astor, puzzled.
"On Molly's ship,"
repeated Arm.
"What on Molly's ship?" said Astor.
"Not know. Molly talk sound."
Arm made a noise that sounded like an attempt at a human voice, but porpoises were ill-suited for this task, and Astor couldn't make it out.
"Again,"
he said, leaning forward, desperate to understand.
"Who goes there?"
a sailor's voice behind Astor.
"Damn.
Go,"
said Astor to the porpoises.
"Go."
The porpoises turned, and in an instant were gone.
What was on Molly's ship?
"I said, who goes there?"
The sailor was right behind Astor, who turned from the rail to face him.
"Ah, Mr. Astor,"
the sailor said, his tone changing when he realized he was speaking to the Wasp's most important passenger.
"I wondered who was making them noises. Not feeling well, hey? You got the heaves, do you?"
"I need to speak to Captain Scott," said Astor impatiently. The sailor hid a smile.
"Beg your pardon, but there's nothing the captain can do about a sour stomach, sir."
"It's something far more urgent than that," said Astor.
"But, sir, with respect, it's just past 5 in the morning, and the captain would have me keeled if..."
"Never mind," said Astor, pushing past the protesting sailor. He strode to the ladderway, descended it, and pounded on the door to the captain's cabin. In a moment, the door was opened by Captain Scott, pulling his pants on over a long nightshirt, looking ready to tear the head off whoever had disturbed his slumber. His anger instantly turned to surprise when he saw who had awakened him.
"Mr. Astor,"
he said. "Captain Scott, please accept my apologies for this intrusion, but I must speak to you immediately." The sailor clambered down the ladderway, puffing.
"I'm sorry, Captain," he said. "I tried to tell Mr. Astor that..." "It's all right,"
said Scott.
"Back to your watch."
"Aye, aye, sir,"
said the sailor, leaving.
"Please come in, Mr. Astor,"
said Scott, stepping back so the tall man could enter his spotless, tidy cabin. Astor shut the door behind him and turned to face Scott. His expression was intense. To Scott, it almost looked as though the tall man's green eyes were glowing. A trick of the lantern light, Scott thought.
"Captain Scott," Astor began, "you know of my diplomatic status. You understand that I am on a mission for the Queen herself."
"I do, sir."
"And you understand that, as such, I am privy to certain information that is not generally available."
"I imagine you are, at that."
"Captain Scott, I ask you not question how I might know what I am about to tell you, but only to trust that it is true. A pirate ship now approaches the Wasp, intending to do her harm."
"Approaches?"
"It is very close, I fear."
"But, Mr. Astor, that is not possible," said Scott. "Our lookouts have seen no other ship for days, save for the frigate flying the Union Jack. She may be an impostor, but even if she means us harm, she'll never catch the Wasp."
"I hope you are right, sir, but if an enemy should overtake us..."
"He will not, I assure you."
"Just so, but if he does..."
"Then we shall fight."
"And I trust that we shall prevail, Captain Scott. But whatever happens, understand this. The special cargo that this ship carries for the Queen must not fall into our enemy's hands. It must not. If that were to happen, the consequences would be dire. More dire than you can imagine."
"Then I shall make sure it is well protected," said Scott. "But I assure you that no such protection will be necessary. As I say, no ship can catch the Wasp."
"I pray that you are right, Captain."
"Praying will no doubt help, Mr. Astor, but so will good seamanship. I'll go topside and see to the sails."
"Thank you, Captain."
The two men climbed the ladderway, Captain Scott wondering if his distinguished passenger had lost his mind.
How would he get information out here in the middle of the ocean, and what ship could be capable of catching the Wasp?
His answer came as soon as they reached the deck, which was washed in the blood-red light of the dawn sun creeping over the horizon. The Wasp's first mate, a burly man named Romilly, came running up, breathless.
"Captain, sir, I was just coming to get you. We've just seen it, sir, just now."
"Seen what?"
A ship, sir, closing on us fast, and it's flying..."
"But that's impossible,"
said Scott.
"How can..."
And then he saw it. Less than a mile astern was the frigate, but now she was moving faster than the Wasp, and faster than any man aboard had ever seen a ship move. Even at this distance, they could see the two white waves of wake surging aside as the prow blasted through the water.
"What in the world?"
said Scott, almost whispering.
"What kind of..."
"It's flying the skull and bones,"
said Romilly, fear creeping into his voice.
"It's pirates, sir."
The word was picked up by other crewmen, and shouts of "Pirates!" ran out around the ship. Captain Scott, usually unflappable, stood staring at the apparition bearing down on his ship.
"What kind of..."
he said.
"What..."
Words failed him. He had never seen such a thing in all his years at sea. For the attacking ship carried no sails, at least none of the ordinary kind. Instead of sheets of white canvas, the sky above the pirate ship was filled with an enormous black brassiere, an undergarment of fantastic size as if made for a giant woman. The twin mountains of fabric, funnel-shaped, pointed, and bulging ahead of the breeze.
"What is that?"
Scott gasped. "That," said Leonard Astor, "is Black Stash." The crew heard that too, and the murmur went quickly around the deck.
"Black Stash."
"He's here for the Queen's cargo," said Astor. "I don't know how he knows, but he knows. That's what he's after."
"Well,"
said Scott grimly,
"he won't get it without a fight."
Chapter 14. The Alliance. Peter found Alf the next morning. The big man was down on his aching old knees, scrubbing the deck. The wind was picking up. To the west, Peter saw gathering clouds, dark and threatening, though still a good way off. They made the ship feel smaller to Peter. Alf looked up as the boy approached.
"Hello, little friend,"
he said, grinning. "Seen any flying rats?"
"No," said Peter, "but I'm going back to look."
Alf's grin disappeared. He looked around the deck to be sure nobody could overhear.
"To the aft hold?"
he whispered.
To the trunk?
Yes, tonight.
But there's a guard there, said Alf, and he'll be wary. Slank was right furious at John for falling asleep last night. Had him whipped good and proper. He's put a new man on guard, an ornery old scone called Leatherface. He won't be dozing.
I thought about that, Peter said. I have a plan to get past the guard.
Do you now, little friend?
I do, said Peter. But I need a helper.
I see. And you were thinking old Alf would be your helper?
I was.
Alf stood towering over Peter and put a calloused hand on the boy's shoulder.
Hear this,